Blog Talk Radio.
To Masonic Home Companion, the place for Masons to kick back, join me for a bit of conversation. Hopefully will be educational and entertaining at the same time. Maybe not so educational. More sharing of opinion, mixture of fact, common purpose, I'd like to think. It's been an amazing year, and here we sit on the 29th of December, 2013. This is the 363rd day of the year. Yeah, the year is wrapping up quite nicely, I would say. It's been a remarkable year for achievements, and we'll get into that. There's lots of other things that will, lots of other sources of information about the situation over the past year, if you're so inclined to all of that. If you're sitting back nice and comfortable, we'll get comfortable. Make it purposeful here. Get a glass of, a big glass of something invigorating, whatever that is. If you want to go old school, you can do that with a glass of wine or glass of beer or glass of scotch. Or you want to go more contemporary, you can join the early cafes in the city of London and sit down with a double espresso or cappuccino. Oh yes. Or we can dream of the days when one day, 100 years from now, or maybe 200 years from now, Canada will join the cafe cultures of Paris and London and Budapest and Quebec City. The rest of Canada will find that enormously appealing. Trust me on that. Thank you all for making the year an enormous success for Masonic Companion. I have a couple of interesting articles to share with you today, at least I think bona fide legitimate articles. I wanted to, as I often do, start off with some things that are pertinent and relevant. Centuries have produced some incredible writers and poets, and today I want to share a bit of information about, remember the men and women who have been in uniform around the world from the beginning of time, and more particular, I guess, to the men and women of our country who have served us, served our nation. I think you have set a mark that everyday people need to acknowledge. We don't want to. I don't think any one of us wants our men and women making sacrifices on the battlefront for a nation that doesn't hold its head high, that doesn't do the right thing, that ignores the suffering of our own people. We are at a changing point, a point of change in the country. And it's interesting. It's a good thing. It's a very good thing. We're looking for increased watchfulness and increased engagement. Canada has grown and matured to the point where now we want to know who's making those decisions. And this glibness, glibness isn't enough. And we are about to see some really interesting change and reform going on across this country for the better. That's the kind of country that I want our men and women, our soldiers, to think about when they're away from their families and away from the comforts of life here in Canada. I want them to feel that we're not a bumper sticker, you know, that for them or against them. It's more complicated. It's far more complicated. We want to understand that they're doing things for a purpose that's meaningful to them and to us. That means we hold our diplomats and our politicians accountable to that standard. That's a human standard, isn't it? Always has been, never different. We want to also make sure at this time of year that we recognize that too many of our children in this country are going to school every day hungry. It's not enough to point fingers anymore. Not enough. Been doing that for far too long. It's if we can wash our hands from this. We can cleanse ourselves and say, this is not my problem. Well, these little kids didn't come into the world expecting to be hungry. They don't know that it's going to affect their development and their opportunities, their ability to concentrate. They don't know that. They're just little kids. And they are in Canada. And they're owed. And we need to be able to look at what's being done to help them without this constant belittling, berating, hectoring, withering complaint about it being somebody else's fault. It's not. It's ours. It's our responsibility. That's the kind of thing I think our soldiers, our fighting people, or people in service. There's all kinds of people in service, professionally and voluntarily across this country. We're famous for it around the world. Other countries would like to have the kind of patriotism, that quiet, stoic patriotism that occurs in Canada. It occurred to me that we need to be able to express that more readily. I see the ice storms around big cities. It left people cold and in the dark. It's a misery. I mean, none of us would want to wish that on our friends or family or anybody. And when we see people, it's hard not to notice that people are coming and they're voicing their concerns. They're being upset. We need to be able to remind those people, we'll get around to them. Nobody's going to forget them. And somebody has to be last. Somebody's going to be first. I hate to think that there's politicians wading in to make sure that their neighborhoods are covered first. But on the other hand, there's some essential people that are important decision makers that need to be connected immediately. I can recognize that. I think we all can. What I think about is the boys and girls climbing those icy, out there in icy conditions, those crews. Those hydro crews that are putting things back together, cutting down tree branches. I mean, that's not pleasant work up in the air in this kind of weather. And then that nice freezing mist over everything. Yeah, they take enormous risks and they move as quickly but as carefully as they can. That's dangerous work. No time to be thoughtless and no time for us to be prodding them with a stick to hurry up. They know. They've got the message. They have mothers and fathers and wives and children and daughters. And, you know, they got it. They have best friends that are in there too. So at this time of year, I know that Mayor Ford and people like that will come out and say they've done, you know, give them their accolades, but I think we, in our own way here in this country, we appreciate things. And we don't always go around shooting off fireworks to present ourselves. We're not, we have a deep respect for state. We have respect for, begrudging or not, for the influence of the monarchy, the rule of law, parliament. We are enormously gifted in this country, and we know it, every single last one of us. But it's an unusual thing about the human condition. We can create such enormously clever and beautiful things, and yet we can live in such despair and misery. And we see the world changing around us. China is one of the oldest cultures in the world. They have done so much in the last 10 years to push poverty away. The statistics, the figures on it are remarkable. Full marks, boys. To our brethren in Chinese background, full marks, doing something right. And perhaps the upstart nations and cultures should wag their fingers at the ancients, but I don't know. I'm not so sure that we've got it dialed in right. That's why we need to be able to talk things through and get our best and brightest in positions where they can make good decisions and support those good decisions and not be messing around with cheap politics. Hey, do I sound Masonic? Now I'm having a little trouble with Pope Francis. Just when I think you've got things figured out, here comes a man that I really think I admire. I do. I like it that he slips out of the back door in an evening with one aide and walks among the poor people of Italy. I like that. I like that he lives in a simple apartment, sparsely furnished. I like that. I like it that he wears his own shoes, not the Reds. I like that. I like it that he's looked at the affluence of the church and the suffering of people on the street. And the answer is really clear. It's wrong. It's wrong. But you see how quiet and gently he does it. He's not, well, maybe when he pulled that German cardinal in for, you know, pouring millions of euros into building up his palace, maybe that was a clear message that the old boy was ticked right off. And some of us would say, yeah, he should have been. But he's making a difference. He's making an effort. He's taking this opportunity for somebody from South America to make a change in people's lives. Not so long ago, we buried Nelson Mandela. Funny that Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King and now Mandela. People who understood that ideas, good ideas, always prevail, that the heart prevails, that kindness prevails, that working together, common purpose, brotherhood is essential. Each of them have shown us the pathetic nature of conflict. The pathetic nature of conflict. Have they prevailed? History will be very kind to Nelson Mandela, just as it was and is to Gandhi and to Martin Luther King. The oppression is always there. If we're not vigilant, it's not to be paranoid, not to be running downstairs with a loaded gun when our stepdaughter comes in late and accidentally shoot her, thinking she's a burglar. No, here in this country, we worry about different things. Still growing, we're still a very young nation. Our buildings still have to be monstrously practical. And yeah, I do complain about our sense of public art. Oh, it's abominable. Our sense of architecture, oh, I'm sorry. My soul was born 200 or 300 years ago. You know, we'll get there. But I'm impatient. I'm running out of years. The country is, we have a wonderful sense of humor about it. You want to do foolish things, go and do foolish things. But if you're not hurting anybody else, don't embarrass yourself. Don't embarrass the community around you. Don't embarrass the men and women in our police forces and police services. You know, don't do anything that's going to make our soldiers or our children question our motives. That's leadership. We're getting there. We're doing it right. So anyway, you got it? Happy New Year again. Interesting time this New Year's, eh? You're making a resolution, I hope. You lying buggers, you just never keep them. I know. I'm a lying bugger. I will start off with good intentions. And then about, you know, maybe 11 days into it. It starts to fade a bit, you know. But this year, it's a little different. I was lying in a hospital bed and a nurse leaning over me, and it's like, you know, 4 or 5 days of this, it sort of changes your thinking just a bit. It's like, she wasn't cross. It was more like, you get the message here, you know. Yeah, I got it. Pay attention. Anyway, here, I want to talk to you about New Year's resolutions, eh? And then I want to talk to you about Jane Austen and Robert Frost and ritual. I want to share a paper on landmarks that was done just not too long ago by Don Hamilton. He's a wonderful, wonderful mason that lives down in Guelph, Ontario. And I've got a very, very interesting piece from Petrie's Pietrus Stone. And check the, please, by all means, be a frequent visitor to the British Columbia Grand Lodge Stone website. It's amazing. New Year's resolution. Do you know it was a secular tradition, nothing to do with a religious connotation. Like a lot of things today, we're trying to find, you know, again, figure out what secularism is. It seems to move around a little bit. We find it more common over here in the world, at least we think so. Ancient Babylonians, do you know this? It goes back to that kind of time. Made promises to their gods at the start of each year that they would return borrowed objects and pay their debts. Whoa, Hogmanay? Yeah, I think it's similar. Romans began each year by making promises to the god Janus, for whom the month of January is named. So, if you're of that persuasion, you can make promises to the god Janus and the return borrowed objects and pay your debts. I'm going to have to pay my debts to my neighbors. It's been wonderful, wonderful to Nancy and Allison over the past 6 or 8 months while I've been messing around with attention-seeking health. In the medieval era, the knights took the peacock vow at the end of the Christmas season each year to reaffirm their commitment to chivalry. I like that. So go and check that out, peacock vow. At watch night services, many Christians prepare for the year ahead by praying and making the resolutions. There are other religious parallels in this tradition. During Judaism's New Year, Rosh Hashanah, through the high holidays and culminating in Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, one is to reflect upon one's wrongdoings over the year and both seek and offer forgiveness. I like that. If you seek it, you offer it. I like to think perhaps in some kind of proportion. It's like saying, you know, the things that annoy you most of other people are probably your most a reflection of your most annoying traits. I know that always creeped me out a little bit because it's probably had a larger kernel of truth than I care to admit. I know, I'm sorry, you know, deteriorate into that, you know, character development. I don't know. It's part of something called a craft. So people may act similarly during the Catholic fasting period of Lent, though the motive behind, you know, is asking for reflecting on their wrongdoings and things. You think it's a cleansing of the conscience, isn't it? So that we can prevail. What good does it do to bear the weight? Tell me, what your shortcomings, your faults, what good, what benefit has it ever done or continues to do? It weighs you down. It draws away your energy. Learn from the mistakes that you make and move on. Now, moving on isn't carrying this basket of ill will toward yourself. The weight will kill you, man. Let it go. Move ahead. It's not like being an idiot. It's not like being thoughtless. Oh, gee, I can live, you know, do what I want and say what I want, and it doesn't matter. Well, it does. But it has to matter to you first, eh? The concept, regardless of creed, is to reflect upon self-improvement annually. That's the point of New Year's resolution, self-improvement. Not a bad theme for Masons to chew on as they sit down with a glass of their favorite beverage. And here I am sitting here with a nice cup of coffee and, gee, there's something mixed in it. Life's good. Robert Frost, eh? Home is the place when you have to go there. They have to take you in. I should have called it something you somehow haven't to deserve. He wrote that in 1914 in The Death of a Hired Man. Some say the world will end in fire. Some say in ice. The land was ours before we were the land's. Happiness makes up in height for what it lacks in length. Savor those moments of contention. Savor them. And it's not that, I don't know. If you've found that purity of thought and you can be content in that state of mind and not make a bloody fool of yourself, by all means, go ahead and do it. By all means. You think about Robert Frost, eh? He wasn't Canadian. He should have been. But he was born in San Francisco. Lucky him, but in 1874, so lots of stuff going on, you know, port city. But nobody in the States, you know, it's like, you know, the talent is rarely recognized at home. You know, there's talent, it's generally it goes somewhere else, is recognized, and then is imported back home. You hear that quite often about performers. Nobody really paid attention. They were sort of the introvert in the class, and they were ignored. And then they come back as somebody because they went somewhere else. But Robert Frost was he was published in England before he was published here in America. So it's almost like our early, you know, musicians having to go over to England to establish themselves, gain some credibility, and then come back. Well, I think that stopped. I think it's maybe even gone the other way now. Yeah. He was an American. His work was initially published. He's highly regarded for his realistic, you know, the way he could describe rural life and his command of, you know, colloquial speed, the way people spoke normally. Yep, the country is not rural anymore. Most of the world is not rural anymore. We still have open space, but the opportunities in the country have changed. And to think they weren't always there. They weren't always there. Rural life was a, you know, scraping by. In the days, it slid back into the days and the times of the clans and the clearances and the famines, where people would starve. There was no remedy. Rural life was hard. It was hard. Scraping a living out of the land, you depended largely on the seasons, didn't you? All of your hard work, you'd be a very, very good farmer and understand your livestock and how to manage them. And then the climate wouldn't agree with you. And then later we find that the banks wouldn't agree with you. It's a Wonderful World is a movie, a Jimmy Stewart movie that's played this time of year. You know, when it first came out, the FBI tried to ban it, said it was too communist. That was back in the day when everything was a reflex. These are people that have no understanding what it is. Communist, socialist, left, right, they don't care. They're just making a point. But it was too common. You want to hear? Because it made the banker look bad. Oh, God. And I carried on, and, you know, they were going to ban it. And then somebody pointed out, well, you know, it's about money, and money can be used for good or for evil. You know, you can be a, you know, that miserly, you know, we'll just foreclose on you. Well, our banks, you know, banking system, like anything else, the big systems, you have to keep an eye on them, make sure they're playing by something that's acceptable by us. Nobody else makes the rules. We do. If we think it's reasonable and fair, fine. If we don't, we do something about it. Eventually, the FBI pulled in their horns and went away. I guess they were sulked. They probably tapped phones. Yes, do at this time of year, brethren, do I want to thank Snowden for, is this, I'm talking about heroes or heathens, you know? What are we talking about here? Frost was illustrating country life, and in a way that a lot of people could grasp. Today, the country life isn't what it was during my boyhood, and it's too simplistic to think that you know. Well, if you have a means, you can live in the country. If you're a productive farmer, you're there already. But if you're looking for opportunity and you're a young person, you're going to follow, just as anybody always has. You're going to follow the opportunity, aren't you? And if there's opportunities on the fringes of cities, that's where you're going to be. That's where you're going to be. And if there's opportunity in the rural area, well, there is opportunity, but it's not as great. The numbers aren't as great. And rural, you know, now rural is starting to be defined globally, not too unlike what's happening with Freemasonry. Rural is we have to think about rural in France and the United States and China and Vietnam. Well, if you read very closely to the reports coming out of all those countries, you find that everything's moving towards city life, development, more cash. And now we're getting into that, you know, that nice problem of redistributing things fairly. And that's plaguing our world right now. You can tell by the vibrations of that problem that it's not going to go away and it will be resolved. I don't have an answer for that one, but it's like human rights. It's never, you can ignore it. You can be a despot. You can try and kill everybody that talks about those types of things. But the question is never ever going to go away. Until it's dealt with, and it is. Let's talk about. Frost talked about rural stuff. He says, "I never dared be radical when young, for fear it would make me conservative when old." He says here in the Self-Seeker, 1914, pressed into service means pressed out of shape. You nasty. You had me for a while there. You had me. You just, yeah, okay. I'm sitting here a few pounds. That's my resolution, I promise. I have to shed a few pounds, get myself back into that, middleweight. And not just one leg. Here's something that a very good friend, David, has on his wall. And then I'll slide into a little bit about what the soldiers in the First World War were reading, okay? Soldiers' theme for this short period of year. And then I'll talk about landmarks and things and change in their order. We'll finish up with things more Masonic and a little bit of, graphic kind of music that will affect our genes if you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you. If you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting you too. If you can wait and not be tired by waiting or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating. And yet, don't look too good, nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make your dreams your master, if you can think and not make your thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken and stoop and build them up with worn-out tools. If you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it all in one turn of pitch and toss and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss, if you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long before they are gone, and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you, but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and which is more, you'll be a man, my son. Rudyard Kipling, If, a father's advice to his son. Rudyard Kipling's only son was killed in the First World War. Yeah. You know the misery of the troops, eh? Industrialized, this is the introduction of industrialized battle. And we have memories of Canadians that have fought and were part of the slaughter. And it would be easy to point a finger at the generals, except they were trained with the saber and the horse. And the enemy was industrializing with guns and tanks and bombs, an aerial bombardment, and mortar and gas. So the bravery of the charge was confronted by the impersonal, cold slaughter. A lot of horses and men drowned in the mud of the battlefield, It rained and rained and rained. The bugs and the cold, and they were hungry. And when they had a break, they needed something to read. These were men like you and me. Yeah. You know what they read? You know what was popular? Yeah, of course you do. Jane Austen. Yeah. She published a work, and nobody paid a whole lot of attention to it. She published her first book by herself. She took the profits, but she published it by herself. So the early soldiers wanted her work. It was being published, and it was in print cheap. It was available quite cheap. Jane Austen, she was born on the 16th of December, 1775, and she was a novelist of romantic fiction. And this was interesting because it's a type of writing. They place their primary focus on relationships and the romance and love between two people, and must have an emotionally satisfying and optimistic ending. Through the late 20th and early 21st centuries, these novels are commercially two varieties. One's they're shorter books with a one-month shelf life and single-title romances. So you can see, if you're over there and you're battling away, what would you want to have? What message? What would you want to read? You want to be able to escape the misery of the battlefield. And these stories ended positively. When you're alone and you're frightened, it sure as hell makes a difference. I don't hear anybody mocking them right now. Do you? If you've never read her work, you want to connect, you need an excuse because it's, you know, not manly. I hope none of you are so shallow or insecure as that. But pick up one of her, here's what some of the, she has a huge world following now. Now, you can join, there's clubs, you can join. She lived her entire life on the lower fringes of the English gentry. You know, there was money, but she was educated by her dad and older brothers, and she did her own reading. And her family gave her support as a writer. She did an apprentice from her teens into her 30s, and she experimented with different types. One's called something called the epistolary novel, which she it didn't catch on, I don't think. And then from 1811 to 1816, she released Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice. Try it. You can get them. They're still in print, and you can get them at used bookstores. Don't pay full price for them. Go and get it used. It's the best, you know. Other read. Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice. In 1830, Mansfield Park in 1814, and Emma in 1816. And she achieved success as a published writer. And she wrote two additional novels, Northanger Abbey and Persuasion. And they were published after she died in 1818. She died in 1817, actually, in July. And she had begun a third, which was eventually titled Sandition. But she never did finish it. And her works, though, critique the novels of sensibility. These are the things that were being written in the second half of the 18th century and are part of the transition to 18th century realism. I guess, you know, I bring this type of material into Masonic Companion because I think it gives us an idea of what shaped the thinking of our early brethren when they were crafting the constitutions and ritual. I think it really, it reveals, it gives us a richness that we can connect with when we understand what they were reading and what was being topical. And then today you and I can do the same thing. We can read the material see if it speaks to us. We are 21st century Masons. But if you want to know about, you know, is it, I guess I think it's wonderful that our soldiers today can get on Facebook and see their little kids when they're still in duty. They've got some off time. They can talk to their wife with Skype. I think they're their girlfriends or their parents, you know, or their brothers. I think that's remarkable. And if somebody says, you know, hang in there, I'll buy you a beer when you get home, and we'll talk about it and share a few laughs about the Leafs, whatever it takes to connect with your part of Canada. Like, it's excellent. In those days, the days of the war in 1914, didn't have all that, but they had this. Soldiers, when they're asked what they wanted, this is one of the things they did. And they, when they're finished, they passed it around, of course. So when you had a little bit of downtime, somebody's not trying to gas you or blow you up, you could pick up a book and read. I think that's a wonderful statement about. And it defines the battlefront, and it defines the soldier to me. So check it out. Check it out. We'll kill you. You don't know a whole lot about her. And you might find, my goodness, if anything, you might find that Masonic Companion is actually useful. You know, it could happen. I'm not saying it does, but it could happen. Want to know a bit about landmarks? Yeah, of course you do. And more things Masonic than you, so you can work them into your social conversation. I know. You're out there talking about esoteric and exoteric Freemasonry over your martinis. Fantastic. I'm talking to a fellow from over in Barrie the other day. Mark Linnemuller, and we're just cranking up some really, really interesting education, setting it up for an organization over in the Barrie area. Just so exciting. And of course, we're talking to that. Who knew? And we share, you know, like we do with you, we share a lot of interests in common. And we're able to say there's a lot of things about the order that are very, very chewy. You know, you really have to sink your teeth into them to understand. And that's where the benefit of fraternity and brotherhood is so important. You learn, you read, and then to really make it, you have to digest it. And you may, adapt, I think, and I subscribe to this, adapt a method of shula, the schools where you are matched with somebody else, where you have a fellow that you work with, and you talk about what you're reading and you talk about what you're learning. That's how it starts to really begin to be understandable. And that is, after all, what we're trying to do. It's not just reading, whipping through the covering the words in a page. It's really to understand it. And then once you understand it, you're pulling the meaning out of your material, you are able to ask each other, you know, what does this say to me? And the other fellow, it will say something different to him. And is there a rightness in all of that? That's the wonder of it all. That's the wonder of your study. Fabulous. So we're going to explore ancient landmarks. Yeah. And this isn't done by me. Remember, this is done by somebody else. And I'll just edit out some things the Graham editing, hopefully you'll fill in the blanks, but you'll also see my type of thinking, the things that I'm sitting here with a very, very old book called The Ritual of Freemasonry. So I speak candidly about a lot of things because it's public record. And if somebody is, you know, making a big hoodoo of people looking over our shoulders, well, man, haven't we had that issue for a couple of hundred years? Concerned about people taking things out of context? Hey, think about it. The experience they can't take from you. That's in your heart and your mind. You can describe part of it, but it's not the whole experience. Nobody can take that from you, nor can you put words to it. And somebody taking a little piece of information, taking it out of context, and you know, our history tells us that That's dangerous. It's ridiculous when Freemasons do it. You know, we are patient when our edited apprentices are doing it because they're learning. They're trying to piece together. You have this mixture of fact, and then you have opinions about all those facts. That's it's like walking into the Louvre or the, you know, the Hermitage, where you have all of this artwork, and a Mason like me is saying to you, well, what's really the best sculpture in the place? Well, what's your criteria? You know, what's your criteria? I once asked my friend Terry that. He's a curator of Inuit art for the world, and I asked him that. Well, you know, tell me, I am sitting in these galleries, and I can't have a chance to buy sculpture and prints that are sought after around the world. Like, how do I distinguish a piece of crap? And he said, you know, if you like it, it's good. There. So if you like it, it's good. What makes something better? I guess if you study things a little bit, you wonder, like, why is it the whole room over there following that piece of, you know, looking and oohing and cooing over that piece of art? You might want to do a little bit of reading, you know, or ask a few questions or talk or get somebody that you trust to sit down with you and say, now, do you notice how that person interpreted? Of course, then you'll end up, you know, a slave to Monet and Van Gogh and Manet. Huh. What a wonderful time we live in. Get this, boys. Where were you made a Mason? yes. And in the body of a lodge. Yeah. And that, do you know that phrase has been with us since William Preston's time, about 1775. We're also, you know, framing this that we, when there was no Big Bang, it was like, you know, little bang, little talk, little drink, started an order, needed a constitution, lots of guys busy. It was gaining inertia. You know, I'm saying to you, we're going to build a cathedral. All right. So what do we need to do? Well, we'll just go and get those stonemasons. You go down and we'll just start to pick the stone and we'll start to get you to carve some of that, you know, cut some of that out of the quarry and bring it. Well, that's not the way quarries are built, are they? Well, we need lumber. We do need stone. We need artisans. We need rough handlers. We need food for them. We need shelter for them. So we've got to have, we have logistics. We have site managers. We have craftsmen. We have tradesmen. We have architects and engineers. And you know, it all explodes at once. It's not like, well, we go in a line. It's not linear. It's like everything happens. And the more experienced fellows can make all of those things happen at once. So multitasking, we didn't invent any of this. Maybe, you know, maybe we're at the knee of the people that did. I like to think so. I love the metaphor with the operative Mason. So think about that. Where were you made a Mason? Next time you hear it, remember William Preston's time, about 1775. Factual? Yeah. Do we know that precisely? We're working on that. I have another article coming up here, and that will help put this together, I think, beautifully. And before that, about 1696, the answer, you know the answer, but, you know, fill in the blank, modern. The answer was in a true and perfect lodge, or a just and perfect lodge. That was before that, 1696. The change in our present text came during the creation of the United Grand Lodge in England. United, the key word here, United Grand Lodge. And that was after the reconciliation of the ancients and moderns. And the ancients, as we heard last week, had their hand in the chapter, didn't they? And they're included constitutionally as a part of the third degree. So if you want to understand why, get cracking, get into the books and make up your own mind. This isn't a place, this isn't a world where we can follow the ideas of somebody else. This is you're part of an order where you have an opportunity. You took an oath. You gave obligations. You have an opportunity. And we'll help you. We'll help you. Don't worry about it. Somebody helps me, like you guys out there, you fellows, you listeners, you help me constantly. So what makes a lodge just? In archaic usage, the word just is a reference to justice and to laws. No laws are more important than God's law. So the reference is to the holy book. the sacred law unfolded, because it is understood to contain the dictates of an unerring being. It must therefore be considered the standard of truth and justice. This done, full marks. Wow. That is excellent. Now, what makes a lodge perfect? Number seven. You know the ritual, so I'll get into that. This oblique reference is to explain the liberal arts and sciences. Five hold, and seven or more. This reference is to our interest in extending our learning beyond what is merely required for our job. Ah, which brings us to the kind of conversation we like to have, you and I. A Mason is directed to explore the liberal arts and sciences. The well-rounded mind is encouraged. Well-rounded. No dark corners there. You know, when you have a smooth surface, there's no corners. A rounded surface, curved surface. What makes a lodge regular? Charter, warrant, and constitution. These elements reflect our participation in Masonic lodges, supported by and supporting the system of Grand Lodge, lodges and the rules of conduct. Here, Don gives us a little advice here. If you get nothing else, he said, understand. These three little words form the guidelines of our conduct in life. Also, the proper formation and operation of a Masonic lodge and the guidance we are given to make ourselves well-rounded individuals who are educated in all the arts and sciences. And also the form and structure not only of lodges, but grand lodges as well. And now for the work of the address. This is wonderful paper. He's concerning a principle first introduced in the Fellowcraft degree. And while you were then cautioned not to try to discover any of the secrets of a superior degree, this material does not constitute any parts of the secrets of the Fellowcraft degree in this setting. It is quite pretty. Okay, there you go. Huh? No secrets. Shall I continue? It's quite proper that we should now and hereafter try to discover the secrets of Masonry. It is a very curious thing, while forming the foundation of the entire craft throughout every recognized Grand Lodge in every country, these founding principles are very poorly communicated and rarely presented. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This new concept, first communicated in the Fellowcraft degree, is the contained within and linked to the word landmark. This word is contained in the last paragraphs of the final charge. An experienced master will guard the landmarks against encroachment. Yeah. So we know that using this term secularly, it's an object or feature of a landscape or town that enables someone to establish their location, a landmark. Or, you know, it's a milestone. And this definition can be described as a prominent or well-known object or a feature. Fair enough. In the modern sense, most of us don't live in the countryside where a landmark might be a corner post at the boundary of our farm and neighbors. You know, like driving into through Brampton back in the day, I used to turn left at the Red Barn. It was a working farm. And then one day I went and it was, it was a mall with about a 25-story apartment building and no Red Barn. It must be obvious to you that a landmark must be permanent. No point in telling your friend to find your house by looking for a light in the window. It's good. It's clever. So interesting. So the definition is an event, a discovery, or change marking an important stage or turning point in something. And then this definition would support the understanding that this is an important or unique decision. You know, something special about this. Remember, permanence. And we need to consider this on an intellectual level. In a physical sense, then, or perhaps even on an intellectual sense, a landmark can define a boundary. Yeah. So now we think of landmarks as identifiers of a place, as guideposts for our travels, and even limits or boundaries. The traditional use of landmarks is then to be a limitation in a physical sense. Landmarks can be defined in an educational sense. Romans did not have the zero that we understand at beginning one less than one. They didn't have that. They didn't have the concept of zero. The concept of zero was first understood by the Indian Brahmagupta. around 650, and was further. That's, you know, there's our binary boy, eh? And that was you've heard about the Fibonacci numbers. Well, it was refined after that by Fibonacci and Descartes, Newton, and Leibniz. These are profound thinkers, and you know how to spell Descartes. Descartes, okay, Newton, you know how to, Fibo, Fibonacci, and Leibniz, Leibniz. Go check those out. Interesting thinkers. And for a time, use of the zero in calculations was illegal. Who knew? In that mathematical liberal sense, the discovery of zero must be a landmark. Yeah, makes sense. Since education is primarily a cognitive exercise, there must be a cerebral component to the creation and recognition of those landmarks. That cerebral exercise invites the creation of a list of what constitutes a landmark. It shows up. The word landmark does appear in a ritual and in the Book of the Work, and new worshipful master promises in the ceremony to abide by it, never change it. So it's kind of important if you said, well, what is it we're swearing never to change, and what do we, you know, might behoove us to have a fairly substantive opinion. Most of the ritual found in the Book of Work is governed by the rubrics. There's instruction. There are a couple of references in the Constitution providing rules for the conduct of the work, such as the place in the work for a second candidate to be brought in, and that type of thing. Generally, the Book of the Work and Constitution are quite separate, even more removed from the conduct of the work, and the normal operation of lodges is the publication of proceedings of Grand Lodge. True. And so in a Masonic sense, notwithstanding the foregoing, there's no definition of what a landmark might be, nor a list of what we consider or are allowed to consider to be Masonic landmarks there in the Grand Lodge of Canada and the province of Ontario. And that allowance, being allowed to do it, it's not putative, it's guidance. It's guidance. It's to give some structure to our research and our thinking. Because I can tell you quite candidly, if you think about it, excuse me, it can be a minefield. You concept creep. Oh my goodness! It's like this is giving us a leg up. Just like the ancients did when they said, you know, when you walk into a lodge, don't talk politics, don't talk religion. Yeah, they're not telling us like, oh my goodness, it's punitive. It's like, what did they know? What did they know? They gave us this huge, huge gift, and you and I thrive in that kind of atmosphere thanks to those landmarks. However, I digress. Landmarks are not defined in the Book of Constitution. They're referred to, you know, I think you hear people say, well, some jurisdictions, they have them clear. Well, we don't, for a reason. They may not be obvious to you. You have to do a little work, don't you? My goodness. One might be wondering what application there is for the ideas and principles contained in the ancient landmarks. And from the proceedings of the Grand Lodge of Canada, we clearly see that these principles, although unspecified and undocumented, represent our most fundamental values. The Grand Lodge Committee on Fraternal Relations receives requests for recognition of Grand Lodges. And these requests are considered and recommendations of me based on three criteria. Is there legitimacy of origin, territorial sovereignty, and adherence to the ancient landmarks? The recommendation of the committee is generally accepted by Grand Lodge and will lead to formal recognition being granted or withheld for any new Grand Lodge that has been created. It is generally agreed that the ancient landmarks must have existed since time immemorial. Yeah, that's like, you know, forever. In English law and its derivatives, time immemorial means the same as time out of mind, a time before legal history and beyond legal memory. So in 1275, by the first statute of Westminster, the time of memory was limited to the reign of Richard I, Lionheart. Beginning in the 6th of July, 1189, the date of the king's accession, ceded to the throne, In 1832, time immemorial was redefined as the time whereof the memory of man runneth not to the contrary. You know, so it's just like you forget. You know, we have no reason. We can't remember the argument. So, you know, that's out of memory. Most Worshipful Brother Daniels often refers to an opinion offered by Harry Carr, Right Worshipful Brother Harry Carr, who went very far out on a limb and defined what landmarks are. Not to be confused with what the landmarks are, but what landmarks are. So there's different the landmarks and landmarks. Wording. A landmark is that which, if changed, would make a material change in Freemasonry. Well, I like that. Has anyone made a list of the landmarks? Yeah, you know, Albert Mackay did. Yeah, he's a fairly serious man. 1858. So you want to hear them? Sure. Modes of recognition, the division of symbolic masonry into 3 degrees, system, you know, some would say that's not, you know, the 3 degrees aren't a landmark. Third degree didn't exist at the time of the formation of the first Grand Lodge. Okay. And the legend of the third degree, the Hiramic legend. Okay. And the government of the fraternity by a presiding officer called a Grand Master. Okay, that makes sense. The prerogative of the Grand Master to preside over every assembly of the craft. So it's like we can't ban the Grand Master. It can't be a palace coup. The prerogative of the Grand Master to grant dispensations for conferring degrees at irregular times. Now, you know that that came out of some of the weirdness that was going on back in the day, when there were some charlatans and, you know, cowens and people doing some pretty wacky things and saying, oh, it's all legitimate Freemasonry. Well, it wasn't. There were just spin doctors all over the place. Not too uncommon what was going on today. So they put their foot down and said, no, we have to, you know. It's not like, oh, gee, what are you going to do? It's like you're doing it at midnight in the cemeteries. And, you know, what kind of weirdness are you trying to provoke there, boys? Prerogative of the Grand Master to make masons on site. This is sort of, it is a landmark, but it's not, I don't think it's very common. Do you? I think the last one here in Ontario was what, about 1950? 50s, in the 50s, I think. But you have to think about the circumstances. The necessity of masons to congregate in lodges. And the government of the craft, when so congregated in a lodge by a master and 2 wardens, the necessity of every lodge when congregated should be duly tiled. Okay. The right of every mason to be represented in all general meetings of the craft and to instruct his representatives. Okay. The right of every mason to appeal from the decision of his brethren in lodge convened to the Grand Lodge or General Assemblies of Masons. Right of every mason to visit and sit in every regular lodge. No visitor unknown as a mason can enter a lodge without first passing an examination according to ancient usage. No lodge can interfere in the business of another lodge, nor give degrees to brethren who are members of other lodges. No lodge can interfere in the business. Yeah, I can see that. Nor give degrees. Well, I think some lodges, they sort of share the work. If they're burdened by a lot of degree work and there's a lodge that's not as active, I think, okay. Every Freemason is amenable to the laws and regulations of the Masonic jurisdiction in which he resides. Yeah, okay. So if I'm over in Portugal, then the Grand Lodge in that jurisdiction, I will adhere to the regulations in that area. Yeah, okay. Qualifications of a candidate. He shall be a man, unmutilated, freeborn, and of mature age. Okay, so capable of learning, capable of understanding. Yeah. A belief in the existence of God. Subsidiary to this belief in God is the belief in a resurrection to a future life. Really stretched it out there, didn't you, Mackay? And that refers to the Junior Warden's lecture, Faith, Hope, Charity, Hope, and Salvation. You know. Okay, so the Book of the Law shall constitute an indispensable part of the furniture of every lodge. Yeah, okay, we can go with that. And the equality of all masons. Yeah, okay. Needs a bit of chewing before you digest that, you know, the quality. I don't think that means lowest common denominator. You don't step down on the level, you step up. There you go. Okay, I'm okay with that. Secrecy of the institution. What did you do there, Albert? Okay, that's a landmark. The foundation of a speculative science for purposes of religious or moral teaching. And the 25th one, these landmarks can never be changed. Let's review the ancient landmarks as observed across Canada. Oh, is this just speaking to me? You can see there's no bias here in this, is there? but they have a disclaimer. The Grand Lodge of British Columbia uses Mackay's list of the ancient landmarks published on the website, but they have a disclaimer on the same pages, which points out the editor's views of what is wrong with each of the 25 landmarks. Grand Lodge of Alberta seems to follow a similar view of your own, and they clearly reference the existence of a list of 25 ancient landmarks, and they require the recognition of those landmarks without either defining them or adopting a list to their constitution. Grand Lodge of Saskatchewan, you know, that was one of the last Grand Lodges that developed. Remember, we talked about that history last week, and it sort of went to Manitoba and then, BC and Alberta, BC, and then Saskatchewan after. Remember that? Yeah. The Grand Lodge of Saskatchewan has a very similar view, but its importance is expanded and included in the list of Masonic offenses. Any violation of the particular injunctions of the esoteric work or any of the landmarks of Masonry. In the Grand Lodge of Manitoba, 1885, from their very earliest days, it said, most of you will doubtless remember that at the last meeting of Grand Lodge, notice of motion was given by Right Worship Brother J.W.H. Wilson that the revised constitution, as submitted by the Committee on Constitution, be adopted in the place instead of the present constitution, which is hereby repealed. This will now have to be considered by you. And let me here express the hope that you will so legislate, ever keeping in view our ancient landmarks, as to present to the whole Masonic world a constitution second to none, and one which will meet the requirements of our jurisdiction for many, many years. May the great architect of the universe guide you in your deliberations. Lovely, lovely, so sweetly worded. Grand Lodge of Quebec website article on their origin and formation of the Grand Lodge of Quebec concludes with the exhortation, remove not the ancient landmark which thy fathers have set. That's they pulled that out of scripture. Grand Lodge of Quebec recognizes 25 ancient landmarks. Nova Scotia, this was, you know, it's citing four Western Canadian jurisdictions, provincial conference back in 1963, Most Worshipful Brother Stuart, B. Stuart Parker, the past Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of Manitoba. So he said, it's axiomatic that every man is presumed to know the law. And so ignorance of Masonic law is no excuse for any of us if we make a wrong decision in this field. Knowledge of the law should help to guide us away from strong decisions. And so as we cherish our fraternity and as we are conscious of the responsibilities of our offices, we should inform ourselves of the law of Masonry. It is bound to keep a subject such as this confined within due bounds. As Brother Roscoe Pound said, in the House of Jurisprudence, there are many mansions. Brother Albert Mackay wrote in the preface to his Principles of Masonic Law that it would make too unwieldy a volume if he were to prepare an encyclopedia of Masonic jurisprudence, so he decided to present the principles only in elementary treatise. He then produced a book of 355 pages. Lawrence's Masonic Jurisprudence is a simple commentary on the Book of Constitution of the Grand Lodge of England. It runs to 316 pages. So ethics is concerned with motives and with the long-range excellence of the individual character. So we need to put ourselves, or, you know, we are the subject of this whole topic. It's not a bureaucracy. It's us, noses, people, Masons, breathing entities, the point. So we're talking about ethics that are concerned with motives and the long-range excellence of us, of our character. Law has little interest in motives and is concerned more with broad rules that govern that govern the conduct of groups of people in their day-by-day activities. If the standards of ethics prevailed, the standards of law would be unnecessary. Hear, hear. In marriage, so long as love prevails, there is little need of law to govern the relations between a husband and wife. When love flies out the window, the lawyer comes in the door. Touché. We hear that Masonic law is either esoteric or exoteric. Esoteric law is made up of those principles of Freemasonry that are inculcated by our ceremonials. This may well be the unwritten law of the fraternity in its best sense. Exoteric law begins with ancient charges and includes all of the additions and amendments made later by the constitutions and bylaws of sovereign grand lodges. Masonic law has been divided into lex scripta and lex non scripta, in other words, written law and unwritten law. And in this sense, unwritten law does not mean law that is never found in written form. It means the law was established by ancient usage and custom rather than by legislation. And it's the law of Freemasonry prior to 1717. Written law defines the laws created by enactment after 1717. Useful structure. Don, your right worshipper brother is just doing us a huge, huge savor, benefit here. And he recommends that we check, we check the definitions. Here's an issue. We also hear that of the division into changeable law and unchangeable law. Certain Masonic laws are beyond the power of any man or body to change. These are the ancient landmarks. All of the rest of our laws are subject to change. So this came in 1963 by B. Stuart Parker, very, very enlightened man, obviously. Past Grand Master of Grand Lodge of Manitoba. And significant, huh? Significant thinker. We are not to regard the variation of potential confusion in the diversity of the list, whatever number of landmarks there may be, but the necessity of observing the existence of the ancient landmarks is a foundation stone of our institution. Even in the most fundamental elements of our institution, there is room for further study and what I have learned, and I hope you share this viewpoint that the ancient landmarks are fundamental and important to Freemasons everywhere, as English common law is to our laws and system of governments. You like? Not bad, huh? Not bad. And then, brilliant, brilliant. We get into the eighth landmark. You want to write them all down for those that did. This is from Mackay's, Making of a Mason on site. The prerogative of the Grand Master is a landmark which is closely connected with the prerogative of the Grand Master to give dispensations for opening and holding lodges in, and he may grant in virtue of this to a sufficient number of Masons the privilege of meeting together and conferring degrees. So interesting paper. I would give this this is a thumbs up. This is interesting, informative, and relevant. My gosh, and the writing is just beautiful. So, Right Worshipful Brother Don Hemel, thank you. That's that was delivered at the Masonic Education Conference in London just a month and a half ago. You can see the quality of the work was just phenomenal. Where do we go from there? Where do you go from there? How do you trump that, huh? Absolutely. Well, you trump that by talking about, you ask. If any of you need to top up your beverage, your bottle opener is outside, just outside your reach, or you need to have a little stretch, go and do that. And when you come back, I'll be well into an article by a Grand Master, a past Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of Canada. And then I want to talk to you about change a little further from the Pietri Stones Review of Freemasonry. And I want to talk to you about researching Freemasonry in the 21st century. So should we talk about that first? Yes, let me do that, because I think the flow is there. And then and because of the topic, and this is Professor Pierre-Yves Boupia, and he's from the University of Nice, Sophia Antipolis. So I want to, and he's a professor of modern history, so I think he speaks relevant, and I'll share this with you. The topic heading by Most Worshipful Brother Norman Brain, a past Grand Master, was given at the 19th Annual Heritage Lodge Banquet on Friday, the 30th of January, 2004. So and it's called Can Masons Change? And so I want to, we'll talk about why the force, the compelling force or reason to change, and then in the professor's paper, and then ask the question. Here's the reason, and it's going to require that we change. And Most Worshipful Brother Breen talks to that. And he's not saying we must. He's saying, can we? It's not like a value judgment. Do we, you know, should we or not? It's like, get off with it. So anyway, it's significant. Masonic, the influence here that the professor is talking about is what's changed about, you know, what's evolved in the world of Freemasonry. And Freemasonry clearly has is at a turning point, at a point of evolution, significant point of evolution, and we're being reinvented in a lot of ways. And I'll explain this. Masonic academic research today has reached a turning point, carried on for decades by academics belonging to the Masonic order or philosophically near to it. Masonic scholarship continually sought out legitimacy from university and scholarly authorities. That makes sense. The research centers, chairs, seminars, and applications for high-level international projects have multiplied, often with the support of Masonic Grand Lodges. In parallel, these obediences created, welcomed, or financed their own research institutes or conference centers. They understand the importance of their heritage. Archival materials, pictures, and artifacts represented a powerful support for the organization, illustrated by the often remarkable public artistic exhibitions. However, the assessment remains mixed. Masonic studies remain isolated and still suffers from a recognition problem. It is therefore collectively that we need to think of the question of the bonds which still link Masonic research to the patronage of Grand Lodges and to all kind of Masonic institutions. There also exists an equally difficult second challenge. The ritual invocations to George Simmel or Jorgen Habermas aside, how can we integrate Masonic studies into research in public space, social networks and networking, history of ideas, studies of individual trajectories, or of the birth of a political culture for Latin Masonry? What do you mean, Latin? Latin America? Not clear for English-speaking an audience. Without making lodges and their members a simple pretext, but by considering them as such and for themselves. The positivist, factual, chronological history of Freemasonry has undoubtedly its own interest. It constituted even a necessary stage, but from now on, Masonic research must not only integrate the academic and professional rules of the researchers in the histories and social sciences. Amazing, hey? Masonic academic research today, it has reached a turning point. It constituted even a necessary stage, but from now on, Masonic research must not only integrate the academic and professional roles, but it must also put on its agenda the opening of innovative fields likely to attract junior scholars. It is at the price of this effort that the academic world will cease regarding it as an unidentified erudite object. There is a question of scientific legitimacy of Masonic studies. Each year, the Masonic bibliography increases by several hundreds of references throughout the world. The abundance of this production is nevertheless misleading. In France, for instance, the recent increase in the number of PhD theses on the subject should not hide the fact that they are the product of both Freemason and non-Freemason scholars, who often analyzed an important amount of sources, but who largely ignore the standard university rules. Really? I didn't know you could do that. So that's interesting. And I heard that opinion. I was at the conference in Edinburgh in May, where Jan Schnuck, Belgian, very, very bright man, absolutely a wonderful scholar on fraternal organizations, world-renowned scholar, a reference around the world. And he excitedly told me that the hotspot for research in Freemasonry is France. So here we have evidence of that. With four PhDs achieved this academic year, the comparison with the number of theses in 18th century religious or cultural history or those of the political history of the 19th and 20th centuries is amazing. In the United States, in spite of the influence and reputation of Margaret C. Jacob, the number of PhD theses is still limited. Let us quote among the most recent ones those of Kenneth Loisel in Yale, John Merriman and Timothy Tackett as supervisors. And this is entitled New But True Friends, Freemasonry and the Culture of Male Friendship in 18th Century France, of Natalie Baer, Margaret C. Jacob, supervisor, Spreading the Light, European Freemasonry and Russia in the 18th Century, who are both assistant professor at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, or the PhD of Jessica L. Harlan Jacobs, there's a speaker at the Builders of Empire, Freemasonry and British Imperialism, 1717 to 1927, associate professor at the University of Florida, and our keynote speaker at the Sankey Lectures. The situation in Italy seems better. The impact of the great synthesis published by Giuseppe Giarrizzo on Masonandi e Elissimo and European del Settecento, I'll have to get my brother-in-law over here to help me with that one, was rather limited. However, in at least three generations of researchers are simultaneously at work, from Giuseppe Giarrizzo to Gerald Tocchini through Vincenzo Ferroni, Gianmario Casaniga, and Antonio Trampas. They all ask original questions. Gerardo Tocchini works, for instance, with a resolutely European point of view at the intersection of cultural history of social practices and musicology. Vincenzo Ferroni, a disciple of Franco Vetturi, is interested in Freemasonry in relation to the history of sciences and academic structures. For the contemporary period, Flavio Conte associates history and political science and is particularly active as the publication of his last book on Masoneria, Masoneria e Religioni Civili at Il Mulino shows. Spain offers also a positive balance with a great number of PhD theses on regional and colonial history of the 18th and 20th centuries, 19th and 20th. But on the whole, Freemasonry still attracts too little of both students and supervisors in spite of the existence of a considerable mass of documentary sources, among which many remain completely untouched. That gets us all to sit up, doesn't it? I am thinking in particular of the files returned from Russia or the files on the return from Berlin. This weakness of scholarly investment also appears in the great national reviews, where articles concerned with Masonic history are rare, even if it is possible to quote a few special numbers, as there is in 1991, and the special issues in Italy in 1999 and in France in 1987, in the 18th Century Review, and more recently the Bordeaux Review Luminaries. There exist certainly specialized Masonic reviews among which we can quote without seeking exhaustiveness. Ars Quattuoro Coronatum, review of the Research Lodge Quattuoro Coronati Lodge number 2076, and Quattuoro Coronati Yorbrick, review of the Coronati Lodge 807 in Beirut, or in the French-speaking world, a Renaissance tradition, and Belgian Masons. But whatever their quality, their audience remains limited, and they find it difficult to attract non-Masonic scholars, with the remarkable exception of Quattuoro Coronati Yorbrick, a model of scientific rigor and opening in direction of university research. Significantly, the researchers of German universities do not hesitate to publish there. Certain specialists have sought to develop university reviews specialized in Masonic studies. Some initiatives are not successful. For example, the one by Professor Dr. Helmut Reinautor. On the other hand, the launching of the Journal for Research into Freemasonry and Fraternalism, published by our friend, our very first Sankey lecturer, Andreas Onofors, and his colleague, Robert Peter, received a warm and encouraging reception. This need to coordinate a too often dispersed research is also the origin of the creation of internet sites and specialized diffusion lists. Let us quote, among many others, Pietri Stone's Review of Masonry by Bruno Gazzo. Excellent. This is what we're referring to here. Some works have been translated, like the PhD of Stefan Ludwig Hoffmann, defended in July 1999 at the University of Bielefeld in Germany. And this was translated into English and published at the University of Michigan Press. And the title is The Politics of Sociability, Freemasonry and the Civil German Society, 1840 to 1918. But translations remain an exception, and it's expensive to translate. If we wish to develop the scholarly production in the field of Masonic studies in the form of PhD dissertations, books, and articles, it's necessary to develop authentic scholarly courses in Freemasonry. In France, the French Masons have cultivated until recently the nostalgia of the 70s, when Jacques Brengue occupied allegedly a chair of masonry at the University of Rennes in Brittany. Actually, and more modestly, he was professor of French literature and a specialist of the 18th century. And he led a seminar on Masonic studies and supervised several PhDs on this field. Both this specialized teaching and the seminar have disappeared since. In Paris, with the section of religious sciences at the École Pratique des Hautes Études, a prestigious institution, the chair of history of the esoteric mystical streams of early modern and contemporary Europe, where Jean-Pierre Brach succeeded Antoine Fevre, approaches Freemasonry only indirectly. In Belgium, in spite of the assumed Masonic origins of the University Libre in Brussels, a complete cycle of Masonic studies struggles to be set up. The Theodor van Hagen Chair, the name of the founder of the University Libre de Brussels, founder of the Liberal Party and Grand Master of the Grand Orient of Belgium, organizes conferences intended rather for the general public, but the courses of history of Freemasonry organized within the Interdisciplinary Research and Studies Center on Secularity since 2007 have a limited audience and are at the margins of the Faculty of Arts and Philosophy. On the contrary, the initiatives taken in Great Britain need to be underlined. In Sheffield, the Center for Research into Freemasonry and Fraternalism, where Andreas Onofort succeeded Andrew Prescott after different fellowships in European universities at Lund, Freiburg, and in Nice, is developing a curriculum in Masonic research both at the BA and Master's level. This initiative is remarkable because it relies on a robust internet site that allows an online education. In the Netherlands, teaching in the field of Western esotericism has been organized at the University of Amsterdam, while the Grand Orient of the Netherlands supported in 2001 the creation of a chair of studies of Freemasonry as an intellectual movement and sociocultural phenomena at the University of Leiden. Its first holder, Anton van de Sande, has been replaced since by Malcolm Davies. There. Now, we know that Malcolm Davies was slated to be the first speaker of the Sankey lectures. And he passed away, don't we? And we know that Brother Andreas, Dr. and Professor Andreas Onofort stepped in. Without question. Saved our project and honored us all in typical Masonic fashion. But I digress again. These creations are a first step. It is necessary now to make them last, to strengthen them, and to increase their academic recognition, especially because the financial support of Masonic bodies has sometimes created some reticence amongst academics, even when the Grand Lodges do not interfere in scholarly aspects. So let us quote finally the Seminar of History of Freemasonry of Professor Kasumi Fukasawa at the University of Tokyo. But it is still an individual initiative which relies on the passion of this academic specialist of the Mediterranean trade and of maritime history for the Masonic history of which he has become, in the meantime, a true specialist. The research centers on Freemasonry, or the research programs, constitute another axis in the development of Masonic studies. In France, there is no research center recognized by the Ministry of Universities and of Research, but of the National Center of Scientific Research. The Center of Study in Language and French Literature in the 17th and 18th centuries at the University of Paris, the 4th Sorbonne, has a research team called Enlightenment, Illuminates, and Freemasonry, created in 1996 and directed by Sir Charles Posset. In Bordeaux, Professor Cécile Ravin runs a seminar, organizes conferences, and coordinates the Charles Posset VAST project, the Masonic Universe of the Enlightenment, a truly structuring for Masonic research. At the University of Nice, Sophia Antipolis, with the Center of the Early Modern and Contemporary Mediterranean and Research Program Center, we also organize, Professor Louis Martin and I, a series of international symposiums, the last one in Nice in 2009, July 2nd and 3rd, on diffusions and circulations of Masonic practices in Europe and the Mediterranean in the 18th and 19th centuries. Research seminars and investigations aiming at offering to the scientific community databases on Freemasons in the 18th and 19th century. Here. These various actions rely on individual scholars, and the lack of specific collective structures remains the standard. Researchers look at our work, and it's just chaos. Nothing is cataloged. Nothing is filed. Very little is cataloged. Very little. And for doing primary research, you're really going through closets and boxes. Do you know, in the 21st century, you need to get this material up to a form where it can be used at the fingertips of people. I guess I'm saying that really out loud. But all of that aside, in our wisdom, we're letting a lot of our manuscripts deteriorate into dust because we don't have proper guidelines or places to store them. And we're at a point where a lot of the paper and books are falling apart. That's neglect, and I think we are going to have to do something about that sooner or later. at least start talking about it. It's just not right to allow key material to fall apart because we just haven't a clue what we've got in our stacks and in our heads. So you're seeing that there is an enormous amount of energy going on, and this is a very serious topic, particularly when we're looking at the development of a link with a serious university here in Canada. So this is where we get schooled. Do we pay any attention to Europe and Britain? Absolutely. Absolutely. Because this will be what we're thinking about at first in North America. And the dynamics here are different but similar, aren't they? The approach to Freemasonry remains, however, very traditional and has difficulties integrating the methods of social history, just as those of the history of political cultures. This is why researchers at the Center of Zaragoza, notably Pedro Alvarez Lazaro and Enrique Mr. Urania, have internationally recognized scholars in the history of education and both of them are internationally recognized in the history of education and Crozism, and both are members of the Society of Jesus. You will know those as Jesuits, huh? Yeah. Or the intelligentsia of the Catholic Church, if you don't mind, left it to found the Research Institute on Liberalism, Crozism, and Freemasonry. That's Krausism. But, you know, Google your little hearts out with that one. Krausism. In the German-speaking world, the principal research center is at the University of Innsbruck in Austria. And that's directed by Professor Dr. Helmut Reinalter. And it adopted a resolutely European approach, which marks its originality. In its research programs and its many publications, notably its collections by the press Peter Lang, focus on the period known as the Revolutionary Transition, which is to say the years 1770 to 1830, with a permanent concern to situate Masonic history in its social, cultural, and political environment. The Masonic inventory and the mobilization of the archival materials of the secret archives of Prussia, the study of Illuminaten and the Jacobins of Central and Eastern Europe are the main axes of research at for the laboratory in Innsbruck. Oh, I wonder what that means. We plunge on here. Now, this raises again the key question of the durability of these structures, which are very related to individual initiatives and their personal influence and reputation. We can't build a chair on individual reputation alone. We need a little bit more. It is also necessary to underline the important activity at the University of Halle, H-A-L-L-E, of a research center dedicated to the radical enlightenment, esotericism, radical and Illuminaten studies, not the Illuminati currently running after Tom Hanks in our movie screens. So, Illuminaten, M-I-N-A-T-E-N, there you go. After being for a while in a rather uncomfortable position, Great Britain has two complementary structures which address to a public both of specialists and interested researchers. The Canterbury Masonic Research Center was created in London in 1999. It organized cycles of conferences given by Masons and non-Mason researchers and financially sustained student research, just as the OVN in the Netherlands, which was created in 2001 to promote and diffuse university Masonic research in the Netherlands. Moreover, the United Grand Lodge supported the creation of the University of Sheffield, thus within a university framework of the Center for Research in Freemasonry and Fraternalism. Since its foundation, the Center of Sheffield has been publishing invaluable sources, like the Illustrations of Freemasonry by William Preston, and has organized conferences and international meetings, starting with the 2002 meeting of lodges, chapters, and orders, fraternal organizations, and the structuring of gender roles in Europe, 1300 to 1200. to 2000. Proposals for a better integration of Masonic studies to academic research. Nowadays, Masonic studies suffer from a paradox. They are at the core of research and sociability and on public space, but they benefit little from this position. Georges Simmel, Jorgen Habermas, and Maurice Aguillon, and the circles wrote in The Circle in Bourgeois France of the same author, Daniel Roche, Franco Venturi, and Margaret Jacob were all interested in the Masonic Lodge as an observatory and a laboratory of public space. This pioneering work was largely produced by researchers who did not belong to the Masonic research milieu and for whom Freemasonry did not occupy a central position in their initial investigation. These researchers opened, exploited, and then closed again the files of the lodges from the perspective of their own objects and programs of investigation. They did not get stuck in the administrative history of the order. They knew, on the contrary, how to situate in a convincing way the Masonic bond, its actors, their strategies, and their speeches and representations in their social, cultural, family, professional, and political environment. But for these same reasons, their work had only a limited impact on Masonic research itself. These authors did not consistently modify the perception of Masonic sociability and its stakes with the community of Freemason scholars. Instead of benefiting from this open to integrate fully into ongoing research in social and cultural history and to put forward its own contributions, Masonic research instead isolated itself and locked itself up in the dead end of Masonology. This is regrettable, as the relevance and significance of Masonic history can only be fully grasped when articulated in a wider context. In other words, Freemasonry is a complete social phenomena. For many Freemasons, there is the incorrect assumption that only Freemasons can write the history of the order, because they consider themselves as the only ones capable to understand fully its meaning and its project. This is, however, not the case in other fields. Most religious history of medieval or early modern era, for example, is not done by clerics, and most political history is not reduced to the study of political factions. Similarly, one does not expect a specialist of submarine war to embark on the Russian fleet or the White Sea, or a historian of smuggling to become a clandestine frontier crosser. If we want to coordinate Masonic research, which is still too often conducted in a dispersed manner, it seems that it is urgent to launch a vast, collective, and truly academic program to feed the prosopographic database of the Freemasons in Europe and in the world during the 18th and 19th centuries. The collaborative and online accessible database will make it possible to show concretely to the academic community that no history of the Enlightenment or of European and colonial elites is possible without taking into account the Masonic membership of so many of its actors. It will be necessary to adopt what one calls in the history of sciences the strategy of generosity. That is to say, to open our files, to offer our expertise, to change opinions, and do away with wariness and introverted perspectives, and to show to all what a well-conducted Masonic study can bring to the wider history of table of history writ large. Well, I just felt like I'm being told, you know, we have work to do. The perspective, this isn't an individual, this is the perspective thing. A collective change. The study of social networks and of individual trajectories of social actors in the past is today a real success. It constitutes another remarkable opportunity for Masonic studies. The rise of research on social networks, and more largely the renewal of social history, make it indeed possible to consider another approach to Masonic sociability, to individual trajectories, and to interpersonal relationships. Today, research analyzes interpersonal relationships without taking them separately, but considering them instead as integral part of a web of relations. The study of its grid allows the historian to apprehend the extent of possible behavior. In the same way, the microstoria, which aims at not studying the social subject like an object equipped with properties, but like a whole of moving interrelationships inside configurations in constant adaptation, makes it possible to situate the individual and not the institution, as we all have done, at the core of sociability. There. It's not friendly people, it's the organization that is an influence of sociability. Freemason membership lists and statements uttered in Masonic assemblies are no longer the only sources available to the Masonic historian. We need to take into account the ego documents of Freemasons. That's their diaries, autobiographies, private letters, and personal newspapers, as they make it possible to understand individual Masonic trajectories. And the social spaces in which Masons establish their relational network, as well as the social, family, religious, professional environment of Freemasons. It is hoped that by better understanding the individual choices of Masons in the past, it will be possible to reconcile historiographical traditions which are too often unaware of each other. The history of ideas on the one hand, and social history of cultural practices on the other, which in the case of 18th century studies in particular ignore each other just too often, whereas they should be closely articulated. Here. How do you separate out the ideas from the cultural practice? It's like saying, well, we're machines. This is really allocating human beings as machines. You can function like a robot socially, but this whole study of the ideas that influence change in the culture, that's something totally separate. Well, it's not. This is not. This is the integration of mind and brain. There I go. In the fields of modern and contemporary history, Masonic studies should also proceed to their own aggiornamento. There you go. Aggiornamento. Aggiornamento, just like it said. By integrating the methods and results of cultural history of politics. It should also embark on a comprehensive history of international Masonic relations, as the one by Dr. Joachim Berger, the editor of European History Online, is undertaking at the University of Metz within the project of Masonic Internationalism, 1850 to 1830. Our research field is at a crossroads and has, in my opinion, real assets to further develop and organize in the objective of obtaining academic recognition, which is essential. Professor, fantastic. This is brilliant. That's by Professor Pierre-Yves Boupère. Oh, excellent, excellent, excellent. Anyway, if any of you are doing high fives with yourself in the living room while you're listening to this, you've obviously been sipping something much better than what I've been trying to enliven myself here. But it's a wonderful time. This was delivered at the International Conference in the History of Freemasonry at Edinburgh, the first one, in May of 2009. So it is a little bit dated, but it's so far ahead of its time. And this speaks very seriously to us. We're looking at some very serious topics here about Freemasonry, not in terms of our administration, which is done to the – oh, dear. Now I look at the hands of Mickey on my watch here, and I don't want to blast through this work by Most Worshipful Brother Brian, because it is just too good. So I'm going to start the next show. I think maybe do something on New Year's Day. That's coming up not too long, and he entitles his paper "Can Masons Change?" And I think you'll agree with me that there's a relevance, because I want you to have a bit of time to digest this paper And if any of you are looking for it, I'm going to try and have it available to you. Just email me. You all have my coordinates. And if you don't, you can find them. I'm available through Grand Lodge of Canada, the province of Ontario. Thank you very much. It's been a wonderful experience, a fantastic year again. Now, how many years has it been that we've been running this program? I think it was in December 2010 when this kicked off. So is this going into our fourth year? Whoa, we're going to have to start handing out bling to our faithful listeners. By all means, I need your help. We need your help here. The production crew of Masonic Home Companion, who is me, and you, need some help. I want you to not necessarily tell a lot of people about the existence of Masonic Home Companion, but I want to improve. We need to take it up. Really do need to take it up. If you can't, I need your feedback from the heart, from the soles of your feet, to make this better. I know you're all in the spirit of agape around me. I feel a strong vibe. I really do. But I need you to be candid. The last fellow that I asked was the senior warden at Spry Lodge over in Beaton, Tim O'Rourke. Tim, wherever you are, thank you very much. And without hesitation, he is so enthusiastically keen as a Mason. You know the type, but just a phenomenal guy, solely committed. He has found his soulmate in Freemasonry, if I can say that. And you know the fellow. You've met him in Lodge, that type of guy. He's great. And he gave me useful feedback that I use. When I'm doing lectures. He's wonderful. I have mentors that give me accurate feedback, and I use that. So anyway, I want to wrap things up here today with a pensive mood. I want you a little bit of music so that you can think about, reflect on your resolutions for the year, celebrate your successes, find that moment, that spark inside of you that inspires the people around you, that brings a smile to the face of somebody. Can you make somebody smile without being overhanded and, you know, aggressive? I'm speaking like an introvert. God sakes. If I'm talking to extroverts, they'll just go running up and down the street saying, be happy, be happy. I don't want you to do that. You've got it. Speaking to the introvert in you. Bring a sincere smile and show that you care. Commit random acts of Masonic kindnesses. And, you know, it will come back to you. It will come back to you in the strangest of ways. A little bit from my friend and just a lovely Mason, John Danelli over at Runnymede Lodge. He sends this along. This is how he started the lodge experience over there. And 4 minutes and 45 seconds. And I'll follow that up with something a little lighter, but I want us to part company today with a moment of reflection. Thanks for joining us. I hope it's been useful. Of course, Rachmaninoff, Prelude in C-sharp minor.
Things in life are bad, they can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, that grumble, give a whistle.
Happy New Year's, boy.
This'll help things turn out for the best. Aim, always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to love and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing.
Talk to you soon.